It's crazy how I've had to learn once you let go of something that's not for you is when all the blessings come in. If you're holding on to something, there's no way that you can grab hold of this. And once you come to realize what's not for you, you let that go. And when you let that go, you open your hands. And when you open your hands, you're more susceptible to receiving blessings and understanding that the universe or life isn't against you.
Hello and welcome to the Conspiracy of Goodness podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Linda Ulrich, and I'm also the founder of a giant global positive news website called The Goodness Exchange. And that website, if you like what you're hearing here, is the mothership of this podcast. And there you can connect with all kinds of people like our guest today who are changing the world in fundamental ways, and we're just not hearing enough of them on the daily news or in our feeds. And we're going to talk to one of those great, measured, and beautiful voices today, Chris Brown. Chris Brown is recognizable in lots of places because of his most amazing voice. His voice has been compared to Ving Rhames and Morgan Freeman. And all the while, he sort of stands in this category all by himself. When I asked my husband to describe Chris's voice, he said it's something like James Earl Jones of Darth Vader fame, and Barry White of 70s soul and funk music fame. And then somehow it's also like, if God were to suddenly speak to us, this is probably what he would sound like. So it's a wonderful combination. And Chris makes a living doing all kinds of voice over artistry, but also he has this amazing story to share with us. And I think after my pre-call with Chris, I had a new appreciation for two things: optimism and patience. So we're going to talk to Chris about how his life story unfolded. And sometimes it was his incredible optimism that caused him to make great decisions. And it made me wonder if optimism and impatience isn't at the heart of some of the tougher decisions that we make with really bad outcomes. So Chris has spent time incarcerated for a robbery that I kind of think involved some impatience and over-optimism, and he will tell us about that in the part of the story. But the part he has so many other twists and turns in his story that I found absolutely astounding from the perspective of what he shares with us that he learned. I write down quotes when I interview people in their pre-call, and I have more quotes from Chris that are wise and thought-provoking for all of us than I've ever had from a pre-call with any other guest. So I can't wait to share Chris's story and share his expertise. So welcome, Chris Brown.
Thank you so much for having me on here. It's cool that I'm being on a podcast called The Conspiracy of Goodness. You know, you always associate conspiracies with something negative or something hidden or something like that. But to put goodness on the end of it, like, it's awesome that I'm being on this podcast. So thank you again.
Well, Chris, I knew when I met you. Chris and I met at an amazing innovation event in Burlington, Vermont called Sea Change. So people that are listening to the podcast often will hear me mention that because I usually end up interviewing many, many of the folks that are at this big innovation conference. And Chris and I met there, and I knew just from the energy that you put out there, Chris, that you have an amazing way of sharing your story in a way that lifts us all up. So thank you so much for being here. I forgot to even mention in the intro, you also have a podcast, a cannabis podcast that sounds amazing. If people get interrupted, I do want them to be able to access that. What's the name of your podcast?
My podcast is called Cannasations with Chris. It's cannabis conversations cut in half, the beginning and end put together to create Cannasations.
Okay, great. Well, I have listened to a few episodes, and you know, I've had a DEA license for the last 40 years, so I didn't embrace cannabis early because I'm a doctor and I had to really be careful about the law and so forth. But I tell you, your episodes that I dropped into are answering a lot of questions, doing away with a lot of mythology, and you just have a really approachable way of talking about the topic. And so I thank you for covering that part of the new world for us all so thoroughly and really responsibly.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It's been a part of my life for a while, and it's something I've had to do kind of in the shadows, you know. But actually, in all reality, I was medicating in a way that I didn't understand that I was. Breaking the stigma around cannabis, I feel like I'm the prime candidate to do that. You know, marijuana has always been associated with Black people and all these bad things. And now I am that Black person that's going to break that stigma. So, yeah, it's a joy to do. It really is.
So I always take people are going to see me taking notes here and writing and looking down a few times. And I always keep track of the number of times my guests give me goosebumps, and you've already done it. And we're only several minutes in. Something about what you just said made me think about how much we all have in common, even when on the surface or circumstances make us feel like we don't. You and I connected, I thought quite instantly when we first talked, and I know this is going to be a great chat. So I want to start with one of the first things you said, or that we discovered together sort of in our pre-call. We kind of decided that you have this superpower.
It's still kind of cool to transform the thought of what I have and turn it into a superpower and realize it, like, but yeah.
Yeah, I recognized it instantly, Chris. So I listened to your story, and through the whole thing, I was like, wait, this guy has a superpower of incredible optimism and risk taking. Like, you just see something that looks to you beautiful and full of possibility, and then you leap. And you identified your problem as not having patience enough to really study something before you leap.
Absolutely. Yes.
And then I thought, wait, maybe that's all of our problem. We have these things that are superpowers, but we have to learn to harness that energy, or what's sitting there as a gift can be a great liability.
Absolutely. I feel a lot of decisions that I've made in my life has been a result of impatience. And I was incarcerated. I've had to be put in a place to realize that, hey, you can lose it all just as you've lost it all right now. But I had to realize that it's basically, I have to exercise patience. I can't rush things, because as passionate as I can be about something doesn't mean that that's where my passion needs to lie or needs to be, you know?
And maybe it's just, sorry to interrupt, but like so many of us, you know, that first spark of interest that you have, it seems like you're acting right there on that first spark instead of letting the idea evolve a bit.
Absolutely. That comes from the terminology, or just even the mindset of strike while the iron's hot. You don't want to lose, like, hey, I just had an amazing idea. I don't want to lose this idea. So let me get this fire going and put pieces to the puzzle to make this thing happen. When all actuality, you might not, one, even know where the puzzles came from. You don't know if you have all the pieces. And honestly, sometimes it comes down to you don't even have a table to put the puzzle on, you know? So that's when you need to gather this idea that you have and then let it gather patiently. Let it come together. I've been really learning about manifesting lately. Everywhere I go, I keep these two books with me, the 369 Method and Manifestation Journal. And this has really worked on my patience. I know that I know what I want and what I'm worth, but all because I know what I want and what I'm worth doesn't mean that I get it tomorrow. But I have to continue to know what I want and what I'm worth continuously to get to where I need to be. So patience is a huge part of my life right now.
Yeah. You know, I think your incarceration story demonstrates what we're talking about the best.
Yes.
So as generous of spirit as you are, you know, give us a little lead up to what brought you to that decision and tell us that story.
Oh man. Well,
I know.
And this is where it all began. Now, I grew up in Virginia. That's where it all started. And I was always told that you have to work for what you want, you know, but I had the work ethic. I knew how to work and I still know how to work and still have that drive, but I just didn't know where to focus it. So I was real big into sports and I wanted to go. I wanted to go to college and I wanted to just leave Martinsville. And they was like, no, you should stay around and get into nursing because, you know, when you get into nursing by you being a black male, you can get sign-on bonuses and things like that. The thing I was thinking was girls. Okay, girls in nursing goes right hand in hand with what I want. So I joined nursing school, and I immediately found out that it wasn't for me. The youngest person in there besides myself, the youngest lady in there was in her late 40s, and I was like 18 going in. So I dropped out, and me and my friend was sitting around smoking, and I remember a military commercial came on, and it was so cool. We had guys popping out the water with guns with the full moon behind them, protect your country. And I was like, let's do it. And so we got up right there and drove to the recruiter station. It was like, we want to join the Army. And my recruiter, Maurice Frank, he was cool. He was like, well, you can't join the Army as high as you are right now. So you need to stop smoking weed. You need to clean your system out and we can get you in. So did just that, joined the military, and I deployed. In the military, we taught to take action right now. When there's a problem, you fix it right now. At a young age, had gotten married and got this person pregnant. And I was trying to create a family, just be a legit, you know, family man. Deployed, things happened, and I hit a hard stint in my life, and I came back to the States. And I was in the military. When I was deployed, I was used to kicking in doors and things like that. But then I took that mentality from deployment and brought it back to the civilian world. And I didn't have money coming like I at one point in time. And it was hard on my family or my ex at the time. And so I took it upon myself to commit a robbery. I wanted to rob drug dealers because if you can take that work and move it real quick for a price, you can get a little money. So that was my mentality. I involved two other people that was in the military, and we committed the robbery. I kicked in the door and committed a second degree armed robbery. A week later, I was in my barracks room, and some suits came into the barracks room and was like, hey, we need you to come downtown and talk. And January 10th, 2008 was the last time that I had seen the street. I went into jail and that was the last time. And the story also, January 11th was my mother's birthday. So I had to call my mama from prison on her or from the county jail on her birthday. She hung up twice on me because she thought it was a joke. And then when I called back the third time, she was like, are you serious? And I was like, yeah, I'm in jail. And I remember her breaking down and being like, we're going to get you through it. We're going to get you through it. And so, yeah, that's how I ended up incarcerated. I did 4 years in upstate New York. And in that time, I realized that I had a problem, and it was patience. So I came home, and because I was in the military and they took me out the military, I got back in the military. And they told me I was AWOL. It was a whole thing. And I met my wife at the time, and I thought I was going to be back in the military. I was going to do the right thing. I had a second chance at life, and I ended up going before a board and getting kicked out. That was a big shot into my gut. And then me and my wife, well, girlfriend at the time, we got married. She helped me create a life, and she, you know, was there for me. You know, she was really a person that was in my corner. I was out the military. I was working odds and end jobs, and then we came to Vermont. And once we moved to Vermont, I was like, okay, we got the money. We can move. We can rent right now. Nobody would rent to a felon, especially on parole. So here I was with me, my wife, a newborn, and my two other children homeless.
I have to interrupt, because that was an act of a sort of impatient optimism moving to Vermont too, wasn't it?
Absolutely. On parole, just everything. I just got to go. If my family's leaving, I'm married, then I have to go with my family. So that was my impatience. And I almost got locked up for violating probation for that. But I had, the best way I can say it is, I had an angel on the inside to throw the diversion for me to do that. And yeah, so I did go back to jail. We ended up having to drive back to New York every week for my parole. And once they seen that I was serious and I was not coming back, they released me from parole. But before that, we were homeless. I remember feeling like it was the end. Like I can't dig myself out of a homeless hole. Like I see homeless people all the time and they're still homeless, you know, but I had a family that I had to create for. And my last place, I remember I begged the guy. I remember his name was Jamal Jenko. He was a foreigner. And I begged him. I was like, please, I've never begged nobody for nothing, but please let my family, I need a place for my family to stay. And fast forward, I didn't have curtains. And I remember him standing in my living room that I had rented from him. And he told me in front of my family, he said, don't get comfortable, you know. You're not going to be here long. Don't get comfortable. And I was like, you son of a bitch, you know. But I moved out in 2019 where I bought my home. Me and my wife bought the home that I'm living in now. And I remember, so hard to talk about. But I remember telling him, come here. When I was cleaning out the place, I was like, come here. And I was like, stand right here. And I was like, you told me right here that I wouldn't be where I was at. And he was like, you're right, I did. And I'm sorry. And I was like, shit, that's not what I was expecting. I wasn't expecting an apology, but because he had apologized and really seen my growth, like it meant a lot. So, and here I am in my own home now. I have my little slice of heaven here in Vermont. I've changed my life. You know, I'm really, it's been a journey. Yeah.
It has. You know, I'm going to start throwing some of these. So thank you for sharing that story. I remember when we went through it together, that first day that we had our pre-call, I knew that you were one of those people who could help us reflect on the fact that we have to look at our journeys in life, all the ups and downs and the sideways and the detours and the steps backwards, as kind of like exactly how we wound up right here, right now, today.
Absolutely. I think we as people really don't look back. We're always pushing forward. We always have to be better. We always have to see progress. But sometimes we have to stop and look behind us and see how far we've came, you know, how far. It's yeah, you may not be able to see it yourself, but if you look back, you can see it, and other people see it as well, you know?
I think that's really important too. Other people see it as well. Did your mom live long enough to, is she still alive? Has she seen how your life has gone?
Yes, my mother is the best supporter I could have. Like, I'm very blessed to have my mother. She's been there the whole time, you know. That's a solid, like, staple in my life, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. So, there is a great part of your story that I think is something we definitely want to talk about in conjunction with this. So, almost all times, we don't have to look back at our life with shame or our decisions or with, you know, regrets or wishing we'd done something, because there's this element in life that I want you to comment on. This could have turned right, could have turned left. I think I shared with you that my dad was a physician growing up. He came from a broken home, ran away from home at 15 because his dad was such a tyrant. And he wound up with no education in the Navy. And he stumbled upon a chemistry book. Just the odds of stumbling upon a chemistry book. And he loved it so much. And he eventually became a doctor, a physician, a family physician. Now, he came from such humble beginnings. And he realized in his soul that life had thrown him some good breaks. Mm. And that the mistakes he made were important too, but he eventually, when he retired, became the prison doctor in our town. We had a big maximum security prison in downstate Illinois from Chicago. And so he worked with a lot of fellas who had very hard lives, right? And he used to always sit at the dinner table and tell us their stories, because he was a really cool guy and people would share their stories with him. And it was always to him a matter of could it turn right, could it instead turn left. Like, accident of birth is definitely part of what brings us through these long, sometimes arduous journeys. But sometimes it's just could it turn left, could it turn right. And we can't beat ourselves up about that. You have that element in your story. Right before the robbery, there was somebody trying to make a phone call to you. Share that with us.
So I had ultimately planned the whole robbery and planned who was going to, you know, who was what and what was who and how everything was going down. And I remember me and the two gentlemen was sitting in the car, and I was sitting there, I was, you know, making sure everything was straight, everything, you know, watching for anybody moving or anything like that. And my phone rung. And the guy who called me, his name was Diedrich Hodge. And he called me, and I it's almost like he was my guardian angel that I missed. He always called me at times to be like, yo, you ain't doing nothing stupid, is you? And I wasn't really doing nothing stupid, but I'd be like, man, he was kind of like my superior in the Army, but me and him were really cool. We used to stay up for 24 hours playing Guitar Hero, real good guy. But I remember he called me right before I went in. And I remember I left the phone. I'm literally seconds from getting out the car, and he called me, and Diedrich Hodge popped up on my phone, and I was like, you're going to have to wait this one out. And I hung up the phone, or I pressed the silence, left my phone in the car, ran in. And when we got back to the barracks, you know, you're kind of on high alert, you know, because once you're in the military, once you have that adrenaline, it just doesn't go down. So when you get around people who are used to that energy, they can sense that energy. And I remember us walking in, and it was like, you know, where you been? It was like, nowhere. You know, eyes wide, like, we ain't did nothing. You know, what you questioning me for? You just went, I got some drinks. And Diedrich walked in the room, and he was like, where was you at? I was like, why? Why is everybody concerned about where I was at? I was out. And it was like, nah, something was different. You know, I called you to check on you. I was like, yeah, but whatever. A week later, I was in prison. And he came to see me one time. And I remember walking up to him, happy to see him, but in shame at the same time. And to tell him that story, like, dog, you called me right before I went in. And if I would have answered, I might not have did it. You might have talked me out of it. But on the flip side, like, if he would have talked me out of it, I might not have been here telling you my mistakes. I might not have been able to grow in a fashion to be where I'm at right now if I would have answered that phone call. a slight movement can change the momentum of our trajectory. And this is the trajectory that I know that I'm supposed to be on. So as much as I say, man, I shouldn't have answered that phone call, I'm glad I went to prison and I'm glad I became homeless. And I'm just glad that I was able to come back from it, you know?
All right. So that makes me think of something that you talked about that during your prison years also reminds me of the kind of optimism with risk taking that can be part of what gets folks in deep trouble. So you told me this funny insight about what happens in incarceration. You're going to explain it much better than I do, but you either learn to do what got you in there a lot better.
Yes.
And then you just go out and do it again.
Yeah.
Give me that whole round. So, you say it so much better than I do.
So I remember, you know, a lot of people, you find positive people in prison, and some of those people will never see home again. You know, a lot of them haven't seen home since. But when I first got to prison, I met this guy who had been incarcerated. At the time, I didn't know, but he was an older man, and I was, you know, I was kind of not on my rah-rah, but just, you know, trying to move and shake and be where it was at. And so I remember I was looking out my cube. I was, you know, in my cell, and he was like, hey man, you trying to go home? And I was like, yeah, I'm trying to go home. I'm trying to, you know what I'm saying? And he was like, well, if you're trying to go home, I suggest you just sit down. And I remember I turned around and looked down. I was like, yo, you old. Like, what do you know? And I looked at his number. My number was 08A5878, right? And the 08 was the year I got locked up. The R was the area I was in. And the number was the person, the number I was given. His number, and still to this day I remember it, was 76R0462. So he had been locked up since 1976, and he was the 462nd person to be locked up that year. And once I got to know him, he had got locked up in like 72, I believe. So he'd done 4 years in Rikers fighting his case. So he hadn't been on the street since 1972. So when he said that, I kind of just sat down and was like, yes, sir. and he told me, when you go into prison, you can either learn from your mistakes or you can learn how to do your mistakes better. And that meant this is a place of crime. Nobody in here got locked up for being good on the streets. So everybody in here is locked up for a crime. Now, when you get released, you can go back to the streets. You can take this time and you can learn from your mistakes. You can be a better person. You can do whatever you feel the need to do. But also on the flip side, you can get with that crowd. You can learn what you did a little bit better. You can find your mistakes and your wrong and make them right on the wrong side. And maybe, like, for example, we kicked in the door. Maybe I shouldn't have kicked in the door. Maybe I should have just waited outside until they came out. So it's like a different, it's the right within the wrong that you can learn. And I took that and was like, you're 100% right. And I don't like hanging around dudes this much. I don't like guys this much to be around all these dudes. So I straightened up and flew right, I guess.
Okay. So that leads us to the next chapter, which I thought was really fascinating. Talk to us about culinary school, because was somewhere along the way where you got optimistic again. Your wife and you decided that the GI yes. Bill was there for you and you should just go for it.
Yeah. Go for it. That's been my motto at this point in my life. So I had came from working hard, doing asbestos abatement removal. You're tearing down insides of building, throwing it in bags, double wrapping them, throwing them out, all while in a respirator, you know, to keep you know, to change the asbestos in the building. So I was doing that, and I remember it was a Sunday, December 10th, 2015. I had got an assignment that I had to work on a Sunday, and I hated working on Sundays. Like I had been working Monday to Friday. I had to work Saturday and Sunday. I was just mad. I woke up, I was like, "Urgh!" And my wife rolled over and said, "Why don't you come to culinary school? You got your GI Bill. Won't you, you know, come down to New England Culinary?" And there is where the seed was planted. And I had all these amazing ideas. Oh, let's start a food truck. Oh, let me do this. Oh, let me do fine dining. It was just so much of ideas and the passion and, you know, that unharnessed superpower as we spoke about. And I dived right in. I had this thought in December. By April, I was enrolled in college. I was a chef coat, chef pants, locked in, ready to go. And that was 16. In 2018, I graduated from New England Culinary with a bachelor's in food and beverage business management and my associate's in baking and pastries. And I was ready to go. I was ready. Like, give me, I was working. I remember at one point in time in the summer, I was working 7 days a week just to be at this cool restaurant that I was a prep cook at and at running the inn at Essex. So I was just balls to the walls in my passion. And then when I felt the time for the food truck to start, me and my wife had a conversation and she was like, "You know what? I really don't want to do a food truck." And it was like, you know, like I was like, damn, I done all this work. And, you know, I thought this, that we, I had the envision, you know, she got her associates in culinary on the culinary side. I got my associates on the baking side and we both got our food and beverage business management. So we were, if from my mentality or my perception, we had the well-rounded team. I needed you and you needed me and we can do this together as long as we got each other. But she is her own person and she told me otherwise and it kind of fizzled out and I was still working in restaurants and I just started, I ended up trying to run a bakery and I had a burnout. And I remember it was because I was working with a bunch of youngsters. I had a burnout. I had gained a lot more responsibility. I was in a hard time of my life dealing with knowing that what I was working for, you know, wasn't going to come to fruition. And I basically lost my stuff at the people at my job. And I was too embarrassed to go back. You know, they was like, "Hey, if you don't want to come back, you ain't got to." And before that, I said, if he gives me the out, if he really needs me, I will be there. I'll suck it up and I'll do it. And, but if he gives me the option to not be there, I'm going to take the option not to be there. And he gave me that option.
You're talking and about I your said, boss after you lost it one day.
Yes, at the bakery.
Right.
And he gave me the option to take, to not be here. And I said, fine, I won't waste any more of your time. A week later, I got a phone call from a guy and was like, "Hey, have you ever heard of this kind of business group?" And I was like, wow, like me just stepping out, I guess stepping out on faith to make this voiceover thing really work, was kind of like the, not the huge step, but definitely a step to make a difference to where I'm at now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we're going to take a break and when we come back, we're going to continue the story because there is so much yet to talk about.
You know how the constant negative noise in our digital lives feels like it's reaching a
boiling point? Now, many of us have tuned out the news and social media almost entirely. Well, it doesn't have to be that way. There are newsworthy stories about amazing progress, innovation, leaps in human potential, and wonders in the natural world, and they're just not reaching the top of our feeds. We can have access to this, but none of us has the time or maybe even the emotional stamina to search through all the doom and gloom news to find what's right with the world. Okay, enter the Goodness Exchange. There, we are giving instant access to positive news for curious people. Did you hear about the recent Harvard study that found that exposure to just 4 minutes of good news can make you 32% less anxious and 18% more optimistic? Well, I don't know about you, but I need those kind of numbers in my life. So if you want to live with more joy and way less fear, it's really simple. First, you join us at the Goodness Exchange. Everyone around the world has the opportunity to access this kind of content. And we've promised no politics for about a decade, so you're safe from all that distraction as well. Second, you allow this new, more positive, balanced worldview to put a spring in your step again. It can change the way you react to your kids, your coworkers, everybody you come in contact with. And the stories we write about can make you the idea person in your circles. These challenging times call for us to wake up and take control of our perspective. The people who use the Goodness Exchange have the ability to react to the harshness of the world much different because they know way more about what's right with the world. And that's a resource. So subscribe to the Goodness Exchange, our YouTube channel and the podcast, and use this content to live a more expansive worldview. It is still an amazing world out there, and you can be a part of it. Welcome to the Conspiracy of Goodness. Okay, we're back with Chris Brown. If you're just joining us, Chris has an amazing life story that involves everything from culinary school to incarceration, unrelated, homelessness, success with this beautiful, magnificent, velvety, deep voice that Chris has. And all of it is a testament to optimism, risk-taking, maybe impatience. And of course, the beauty of Chris's story is that he's willing to share with such vulnerability and talk to us about what he's learned. So thank you for being in the Conspiracy of Goodness podcast, Chris.
This is amazing to be here. Conspiracy of Goodness. That's just an awesome, awesome words to put together. Well, mac and cheese and conspiracy of goodness.
That is lovely. I could never have had a better compliment to be in the same word phrasing as mac and cheese. I will share with people, because I don't know if I've ever shared on this podcast, that there is a magnificent story about this phrase, conspiracy of goodness. It was decided upon in the depths of the beginning of the pandemic in 2020, when the word conspiracy had the worst possible connotations. Yes. And you know, my daughter and I, my co-founder of the big website, we just said, you know, these are the times. We need the idea people who are willing to take some risk, do something a little impatient and optimistic with that phrase. And so I'm right there with you, man. You know, I've made a lot of good and bad decisions in my life from the same place of possibility and being optimistic about where I run off to next. And so I hear you on all these ups and downs. Okay. So let's pick it up where we were with this culinary life. Eventually, kind of went sour, but in the end, here you are, and it led to this wonderful voiceover career that you've got.
Yes. So I've had this voice since I was about 14, 15 years old. And I remember one of the first times I ever heard a compliment was one of my teachers. I came back from summer vacation with a deep voice. And I was like, hey, Miss Walter. And she was like, good Lord, did you swallow a frog? And I didn't understand what she was saying. I was like, I don't know what you're talking about. And as life went and I became from a boy to a man, I realized that I had this deep voice and that I could attract ladies because I had a deep voice. And a compliment that I got from a lady was that I made her eardrum vibrate when I was whispering to her. And I was like, oh, that's kind of, ooh. And I, you know, found how to use my voice in the culinary industry to deliver bad news. You're at a restaurant, you ordered a steak with whatever, and you want it medium rare, and that's what your heart was set on when you come in a restaurant. Well, the server went to the back and found out that they had just cooked the last steak and 86'd it while they were taking your order. So now I had to go deliver the bad news. They were like, Chris, this, you know, I don't have any steak. Can you tell table 27? And I remember one of the first times I went over and I was like, hey, how you doing? My name is Chris. I'm the manager of the restaurant and I have some bad news. I was like, just want to let you know that with the steak that you ordered, we're sold out. And the lady or the family told me, well, if you're the one that's delivering the bad news, then it's fine. And I kind of turned that into, I was the best bad news deliverer that a person could get when they're dining. And that was what I became. And I remember one of my bartenders, her name was Laura. She was like, you should do voiceovers. And I was like, yeah, whatever. And at the time she found this school, it was called Such a Voice. And I looked into it and I went to one of the classes, an introduction. And I didn't say anything. I just sat there the whole time quiet. And I remember he pointed at me and he was like, hey, you, what do you think? And I started talking. And I remember everybody in the room was like, you know, kind of gave me that look like, whoa. And I was like, okay, maybe I'm on to something now. And so I went to did my Such a Voice and I started training and learning how to use the inflections at the proper time and how not to use them when you don't need to, you know, things like that. And I remember because I thought I had this such amazing voice that I was just going to have this bag open and all these jobs was just going to fall in it. And I remember as soon as I finished the school, I landed an overseas job. It was an international job. It was a lady, she wrote me and she was like, hey, you're not what we're looking for, but your voice is so amazing that I'm going to present it to my client and see if we can make it work. And we did. He loved my voice. But then, you know, after two or three episodes of it, he found what he wanted. And so I stopped getting the call back, which was fine. Learning experience. And then I didn't know how to market myself, how to utilize my voice, how to put my voice in front of people who might need it. And I realized that I needed to connect with people. I needed to be more involved with things. I needed to talk, engage, just change my mentality of what I wanted. So, yeah.
Well, I'll tell you that one of the things that you and I talked about that really relates to your story in this chapter, it's this idea of patience for a passion. Talk to us about this being patient enough to recognize that you're going to be passionate about something, but think it through. Because, you know, I don't know about you, but you looked at this culinary part of your life almost like artistry. And my dad always had that kind of advice for me because I'm an artist. I do giant metal sculptures. And he always used to say, Linda, because he knew so many people as a doctor, he knew their lives. And he always used to say, Linda, when your art has to put bread on your table, it changes it somehow. Absolutely. You had a great comment about that, about how much you loved cooking, but it was when it was just like, cook this and cook that and do this right now and cook this now. And then, you know, that changes it, our passions, right? Talk to us about that.
I guess, gathering this passion so quickly and had created a dream that it was my reality. It was what I was going for. But I was managing restaurants. I was managing the front of house, but I was also a cook. And then I was like, hey, if somebody needed help, I jump on the line and can do what I do. And I jumped on the line and started doing just that. And it turned into me moving to back of house. And Oh, I love producing plates. I love cooking. I love the hustle and bustle. Hey, I was a breakfast cook as well. So I love when people come in, hey, I want 2 over easies. I need this. I need some toast. And it was just pancakes, everything, everywhere. And then produce this chaos and put it on a plate and to be beautiful. And I sent it out. So I thought it was the coolest thing, but then it quickly fizzled into a job cooking the same thing. There was no lane for creativity. It was stick to the script. You know, it was no add nothing to it, just do it. And that's where I lost my passion was, like you said, it took the artistry for me out of it. And I remember after leaving the culinary industry, I didn't want to cook anymore. And I got a grill. I had got a small green egg grill. And I started grilling, and somehow that fire in the grill lit the fire back for me, and I gained that passion. But I realized that the passion was for me. It was for me to cook for myself and my family. It was to produce good food for them that I know that they would enjoy and the people that I wanted, because cooking is very personal. You're adding your love into the food. And sometimes that takes you can do it quick or it can take a few days. But whatever your love is, what you put in it, you want it to be reflected in the flavor and the taste and the presentation, everything. And that's what it turned into is I love cooking for my family. Sunshine, clouds, snowing, I love to grill.
So what are we to take away from your story about our own passions? You know, one of the things you said in our pre-call was, where I come from, you have to find a passion or you just can't get anywhere.
Absolutely. I guess more so, I didn't want to become a product of my environment. It's always a negative connotation attached to that. And I knew at a young age that I didn't want to be that. And in order for that to happen, I had to leave. I say this where my passion, my unharnessed passion began, because I just knew I had to go. That's all I knew. Just go. And that passion, okay, now I got what I wanted. I'm out. I'm not there. This must be my road. So whatever it is, let's do it. But then it quickly turned into, hey, pump the brakes a little bit, you know. Don't move so fast. Chill. Recognize your next step. That wasn't my mentality, to recognize my next step. It didn't matter what my next step is, as long as I had a next step. But now I'm older, I'm more wise, and I've seen the growth of the things that I do and the time that I take with my patients, the results of it.
We could probably apply this optimism that leads to risk-taking and not thinking it through. We could probably apply that to almost every aspect of our life. You had some comments about parenting and patience that I thought were very interesting.
So I have 3 children, 2 in South Carolina. Well, 1 in South Carolina, because I have an adult son now. He's 18. And I have my daughter up here. And when I was growing up, it was do as I say, that's it. You know, do what I say goes. Being in the military, I kind of still had that same mentality. Going to prison, I had that same mentality. And getting in the culinary industry, same mentality. We don't have time to talk about what we need to do. You need to do what I say and get it done. That's it. There's nothing else. And then once I became a parent, I realized that I'm going to raise my kids just as how I was raised, because I was raised right. Look at me. Look at me. I'm raised good. Even though I made all these mistakes, I'm still good. I made it at the end. And I remember I would yell at my daughter. And so there was this one incident where I thought math is easy to me. I'm good with math. And I thought that my daughter, you know, you came from these low ends, so you're going to be good with it too. So when the pandemic came around, it was, hey, you can do, told my wife, you do whatever you can. I'll do the math. I got math. And I was hitting her with questions. And the question that sent me over, she just wasn't getting it, could not get math. And the question, I'm not for sure if this was it, but it was a similar question, was what's 3 plus 6? And it's 9. Now what's 6 plus 3? And she couldn't get it. It wasn't connected. And I remember I lost my shit. It's like, what do you mean you can't get it? It's the same thing. And, you know, and I, you know, apologized. I was like, look, I just think you should get it. You know, whatever. I don't understand. She went back to school and she got diagnosed with ADHD with anxiety. And when I found that out, I was heartbroken because I thought that I gave her ADHD by me yelling at her and doing all these things. And we just went through a time period where I was just giving her everything. And I finally, you know, talked to my wife and she told me, no, that's genetic. It's not your fault. And so I was like, well, give me everything back. No, I'm just playing. But I still ruled with a stern hand. I still yelled, you're not doing what you're supposed to. If I yell at you, you don't want to be yelled at, so you'll do it right. Right? Right. It doesn't matter what you want. I'm going to yell at you because you don't like to be yelled at, right? Well, if you don't like to be yelled at, do what I say so you don't get yelled at. That simple. And I started going to therapy and I started dissecting things in my life. And my daughter was one of them. And I remember my therapist was like, you know, talk to your daughter. And I remember I asked her, I was like, hey, you think daddy yells a lot? She was like, yeah, you do. And I was like, shit. Okay, well, I'll chill out. And I've done better. At, you know, that I've came from ruling with a stern hand to reasoning, because I don't mean this in a disrespectful way, but kids, I'll say it like this. Kids are uneducated. They're brought into this world and they have no concept of the world, and they have to be taught these concepts. They have to be shown the way. And of course, my daughter is going to sit something right at the edge of the counter, this glass right at the edge of the counter. Why? Because it's easy for her to grab. It's not the danger of it knocking off. A child doesn't have that danger, what could happen and the results of it. They just do what they do. And I remember recently, just I talked to her and I was like, hey, you think that I'm a bad daddy? You know, I'm going through therapy and I'm working through a lot of things in my life. And I asked her, I was like, hey, am I a bad dad? And she was like, no, you are a lot better. She's 11 years old. And she said, I remember you asking me, did I yell a lot? And I told you that you did, and you've cut back a lot. And I was like, oh, shit, I'm learning from an 11-year-old how to be a better person. And even from that moment, like, I just didn't want to yell anymore, like at her, because for an 11-year-old to see your progress in life, like a child is uneducated and doesn't know much, but they know they can see the change for the positive in you. And since then, ever since she's told me that, I haven't yelled. I have not yelled. I've presented to her what should be done. I have a thing about dishes in the dishwasher. Don't put dishes, if the dishwasher's nothing's in it, don't put dishes in the sink. I remember I walked to the sink and I was like, Nakia, what's wrong with this sink? And she answered it. And I was like, what do you think that I would tell you to do? And she told me, I think that you would tell me to clean it. I was like, now what do you think you should do? And she said, I think I should clean it. And I backed up. And you know what she did? Everything that she said, I was like, it's been this easy the whole time. I don't have to get my blood pressure up to get stuff done. All I got to do is present it. it's cool. Like every day, it doesn't matter. You can learn something new from anybody that you have a walk in your life with. And my daughter is like, I mean, I can't tell you how much my daughter has taught me about myself when I wanted to learn more about myself. So, yeah.
This is a great awakening for all of us to really realize how much children can be good teachers, because they say it like it is.
Straight like it is.
And because they don't know so much of the world, they still think of things in a hopeful way. Yes. And so I'm sure there was some optimism that if she gave you the right answer when you asked these questions, that she's going to see results, because that's what she's seen. Like, you probably yes. were doing this way before you actually were aware of it. Yes. And, you know, I love that aspect of, you know, walking together. So Chris and I are back. We're just going to own it and be transparent. We didn't get to talk about his marvelous podcast in the previous interview. So about a month later, he and I are finishing up this interview, and we'll just tack it right on to all that wonder that we were talking about for the last 40 minutes or so. Mm-hmm. So Chris, one of the real reasons why I wanted to talk to you is because you have, I would say, an outstanding cannabis podcast. And surely there are countless podcasts in that genre, but there's something unique that you're doing that I was attracted to right from the beginning. You know, I've been doctoring for 35 years, so mm-hmm. I got a DEA license, which took me right out of doing anything illegal about 30 years ago. And a DEA license allows you to write prescriptions for really important narcotic drugs and stuff. And so I don't push the line on ethics. You know, when somebody entrusts me, whether it's the government or an individual, with something precious like that and the responsibility that goes with it, I don't test it. So my life has been sort of removed from the cannabis world until it was legalized in Vermont. What, about 2 years ago? Is that right?
October of this year, it'll be 2 years.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And not that I have any judgment or I was a child of the 70s and the 80s. So I have my own life with all kinds of recreational things. But I've been sort of removed from that world. And I tell you, the things that you added to my way of thinking in our pre-call about this topic were really wonderful. So I wanted to share something about this with everybody in this interview. So let's start off by doing this. How about, with this magical, beautiful, velvety voice that you have, give us an opener to your podcast, some opening thoughts with this very intentional and natural voice that you have.
All right. Tune in every Tuesday to Cannabisations with Chris, where I highlight the cannabis industry here in Vermont. I highlight everybody from seed to sale to bring them to the forefront to talk about what they're doing and what they have going on and the positive contributions that they can make to the community. A lot of people still think that cannabis is such a bad thing, that it's such a gateway drug, but in all actuality, it's been proven to be an in-gate drug. So tune in every Tuesday to listen to so many growers. I've had over 50 episodes, so tune in every Tuesday.
All right. Perfect. Perfect. Okay. So let's start right off with some mythology that you might think somebody might be operating with. Because, you know, at least 90% of the problems in our world are from bad assumptions.
Yes.
And so tell me what I might be assuming that I'm wrong about. Like,
One thing that I said, that cannabis is a gateway drug. A lot of people think that if, when you smoke weed for the first time, the next thing you're going to be doing is doing heroin. You know, it's going to lead you down a different path. But it has been proven, once again, it's been proven that cannabis is an in-gate drug. A lot of people who are on other narcotics and things like that use cannabis as a way of winging them off of the hard stuff. I can see how people say that cannabis can start a bad thing. But a lot of the things, like, I have this poster on my wall, Reefer Madness. And I love that poster because it shows how far cannabis has come. Like, one of the things, it says, drug-crazed abandon. Women cry for it and men die for it. And it brings this connotation. I've actually seen the movie, and it's like people are, like, they're you could see like the craziness in their eyes, and it's not the same. And it's just crazy how far cannabis has come. And it's been like, once again, it's been proven to get people off of drugs or help people get off of drugs.
And of course, in my own experience, it's a pain reliever in almost the deepest sort of way. Yes. For folks that, yes, with chronic pain and so forth. My mother was a sufferer of great back pain for the whole last 20 years of her life and was addicted to narcotic pain relievers. And in her late, I guess she was in her early 80s, she spent the last Christmas with us here. She was pretty much miserable every minute. And we had a house full. We had all our grandkids and everybody here, 15 people. And I just decided to take a chance. And I found some THC butter for her. And I would make her toast every morning for about 3 days. And I tell you, we all had, and she had, the best 3 days of her whole life. Mm-hmm. And this is since all this avalanche of problems fell on her so long ago. And, you know, on the fourth day I told her, and she was very, very old school. So I knew I couldn't have convinced her point blank. And I took a risk that was a little tiny bit of deception that I had to really think about the pros and cons to. But, you know, by the fourth day, she had such a great time that she spent the next 3 days eating her toast gleefully. Well, now, back then, it wasn't legal in Illinois then, so I couldn't continue that practice when she went back home. But it was six precious days that our whole family had with her. And to me, that changed my whole idea about what's possible with cannabis. So talk to us about that aspect.
I feel like we're just now scratching the surface to what cannabis can do. We've seen it's been historical. Like, cannabis has always been used in some type of practice. I've even seen in like the late 1800s to early 1900s, they were making bottles of it, like cannabis, you know, as a medicine. And then all of a sudden it got deemed bad. Cannabis is a heavy pain reliever. They use it for cancer patients. Even in a smaller aspect, they're starting to come out with body rubs, salves, things like that. I know Highly Rooted's body butter. My mother, she does hospice care. So she's a guardian angel for people about to, you know, go to the other side. She's an older woman herself, and she, you know, handles a lot of dead weight. She moves people who really can't move themselves, and it's taxing on her body. So she, when I was younger, she was heavily against cannabis, but I never stopped using it. I just hid it a little bit better. And then once I told her that I smoked weed, she wasn't a fan of it, but she was like, "You're grown." And I've, you know, she's been, me and my mother talk a lot, and she's been with me through my cannabis journey, you know. So I had this body butter, and she was talking about how her knees and joints and everything was hurting. And I was like, okay, well, I'm going to send you this body butter. It's THC. It's not going to get you high. It's just coconut oil and an extract. And so I remember I was at Forbin's Finest. They was having an event, and she called me. She had just got the package the day before, and she called me, and she was like, "Chris, this stuff is amazing. Like, I feel I've never had this pain type of pain relief before. Like, I can't believe it." And she was like, "I just wanted to apologize to you for me deeming you bad for cannabis. Like, you're a lost soul or whatever." But she quickly realized, like, oh my God, I've been given this painting of this plant that has been bad, you know, and now I'm seeing the results of it, you know. And she's the one that sent me that Reefer Madness poster, because the generation who raised her was exposed to that. And so they was like, "Hey, this is the truth. This is bad." And it kept going. So for my mother to send me that and me hanging in my studio, it's, you know, kind of full circle type deal. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Now, do you think, cannabis has been with us on the planet there. I am a kind of a science nerd, and I've even read some I don't think it's really tested science about the fact that maybe it's been along for the journey of our brain development for a million years. We won't go into that because I don't really know enough about it to speak about, but it's been around a long time. And we've had it, you know, come in and out of social acceptance and then back and forth it's gone. But you mentioned something in our pre-call that I wanted to just address right head on. You mentioned that part of the reason why cannabis has a negative connotation is because folks have attached it to something about Black folks.
Yes. So the war on drugs back in the 60s and stuff was mainly associating cannabis with people of color. Even in the spelling, the name marijuana, they replaced the H with the J to give it a more Spanish connotation. So there's like, it came from them, you know, when actuality, cannabis is grown all over the world. Like Vermont has such a small grow season, like, but you can grow anything here. Maybe the season is longer in California, so you can grow bigger plants or however, you know, but they associated it with people of color to make it look that bad, make it even look worse. And then there's this bad drug that these bad people are using, you know, and it's just the way that everything has been changed or was changed, because now things are starting to get light shone on. But the way things were changed to associate drugs and Black people or just people of color. I remember when I was working in a dispensary, I always was like, I'm an entrepreneur. So I'm always watching, whether knowingly or unknowingly, the demographics of what's coming in, what's happening. And the oldest person that I seen come in the dispensary, I don't know their age, but they were old enough to have a walker with tennis balls on them. So if you had tennis balls on your walker, you've hit like a 75 and up. Yes. But the lady with the walker and her husband came in with overalls. He was old as well, but he could still walk. And they bought their flower and they left. Like, it was the crowd that I used to watch was, I was always assuming it's going to be like 21 to 45, a bunch of males, a bunch of, you know, people who, you know, colored hair and, you know, but when I started really paying attention, it was older white women coming to buy cannabis.
And that's some of your own judgment creeping in,
absolutely,
right?
Like, absolutely.
We all have it. It's just,
Yeah. I just had Kevin Picard from the 7 Days on my podcast. I was featured in the 7 Days magazine, and he interviewed me, and I also in turn interviewed him. And it was amazing how he was talking about how cannabis is a bad thing. It's been deemed this bad thing, but so many great things have came from a cannabis experience, whether it was in a relationship, that you were in a bad relationship, or you had a great idea for a job, or you had a great idea to start something. But whatever it is, a lot of great things have came from cannabis.
And so, and for those who don't know who Ken Picard and 7 Days is, 7 Days is this marvelous publication in Vermont that people just look to for everything, for the highs and lows and the interesting things. And Ken Picard has been a journalist for them forever. And he is one of our favorite folks in Vermont as well. He just has a way of looking for things to celebrate along with telling us the hard truth as well. He's one of those journalists that, you know, just sets a standard for what could be and what is still existing right now. So a favorite of ours, he's written 2 articles about the Goodness Exchange and the wonders that we've been pointing people to for 10 years. But I'm gonna make sure that we put that episode in the show notes, right?
Okay.
With this. Okay. So just to let you know that anything that you've heard Chris and I talk about, we'll make sure that's in the show notes, and the detailed article that we're writing about Chris on the Goodness Exchange. You probably won't find it on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts, but if you go directly to the Goodness Exchange to see or listen to this episode, you're going to see a lot more things there. And we're going to put all kinds of links to the things that Chris is turning us on to. Now, cannabis too, which we've talked about several of the aspects that such a maligned drug can be helpful, but we haven't even scratched the surface on folks with PTSD. I mean, you're a perfect example of that. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Yes, ma'am. I'm a combat veteran. I deployed to Iraq in 2006 to 2007, and I seen a lot of stuff that nobody really wants to see. And I remember when I came home and from this 15 months of chaos, where you have to go to this medical place and you got to check you out, ask you a bunch of questions. The first night they said, don't drink, you got to have a dry night. And I remember I was like, yeah, whatever. I drank. I was like, I'll be sober by in the morning. But everybody, I hadn't drank in a year and a half. And everybody, when I showed up to formation, everybody was, oh my God, everybody was drunk. But we went there and they was like, how is everything? Do you feel okay? And we were like, yep, I'm good. You know, I'm fine. And it was kind of like we pushed down our feelings. And later on, it affected me. You know, like I said at the beginning of the podcast, I did prison time, and it was partially because of my PTSD. The robbery I committed was very military-esque because I kind of took what I was doing before and brought it to the forefront. You know what I'm saying? So that was something that I had to deal with. And then using cannabis, the best way I can put it is I have a lot of vibrations going on. And when I smoke, it kind of brings those vibrations to be more manageable, if you will. More, it's just a thought. It's not real. Like, you know, things like that. I remember when I first came home from deployment, I couldn't ride on the left. I couldn't be near the shoulder of the road. I always had to drive in the middle of the road because that's where roadside bombs, they always put them on the side of the road. And if you're hugging the corner, you know, it's more susceptible to being an explosion. We've had those and they told us, hey, middle of the road. And when I came home, I remember middle of the road, you know, and even sometimes I'll still see it and think about it. But, you know, it's just something that I've had to learn to deal with, how I've learned to cope with. And cannabis has been a heavy contributor to it. I used to drink a lot, you know, when I came home from deployment and everything. And that was the coping mechanism, was drinking. And we all know drinking can always end badly, whether it's in a relationship, domestic, you know, it doesn't matter. It's, you know, but with cannabis for me, it's been like I'm calm. It's okay. You know?
You know, there's this other little piece of wisdom that you shared in the pre-call related to something you said just a moment ago. You said, you know, they asked us how we all were. We said, we're fine. Mm-hmm. We pushed it all down. Yeah. And at some point along our journey together in our conversations, you shared with me this technique that you do that you're not pushing stuff down anymore, but you're giving it its time and then and then moving on. Tell us about the 10 minutes and 40 minute concept.
So I used to think that therapy was when you go to therapy that it's you're crazy. You know, you're borderline psychopath. So I'm not crazy. I don't need to go to therapy. And recently, for the past almost 9 months, I've been going to therapy. And I remember my therapist, when I first met him, I wanted somebody of my color. I wanted to talk to somebody, a black person, because I know they can relate. And me living in Vermont, I don't know if that's quite conceivable, you know. So I ended up going with the therapist, my therapist, I'm not going to say his name, but I went in and I remember telling him off the rip, I was like, look, I'm not going to be here for long. I'm looking for a black therapist, somebody who can understand me. I don't think you really understand what I'm saying. And he told me, he was like, okay, that's fine. But at least you're here to start the conversation. And I was not expecting that kind of response. And recently I'm going through a divorce and I've been going into my therapist and just emotional dumping on him. And that's what he's there for. And he says, hey, and I apologize. I'm like, I'm sorry. He was like, no, that's what I'm here for, you know. But I've also realized that that isn't healthy for myself. So what I've came up with an idea to do in therapy is to have 10 minutes, I call it 10 minutes of pain, where I sit there and I tell him everything that I've been through, all these things that has hurt me along the way, but I got to hurry up and get it out because it's only 10 minutes. And the next 40 minutes, I spend talking about the positive things that is going on in my life and all the great things that I'm doing, the great things that I've done. And
there's a lot, right?
Things
are going well.
It's really, yeah. And the last 10 minutes, I talk about myself and how I'm more than what I think. A lot of times, just as a man, like, I don't think my feelings matter. I think that people think that I'm supposed to, or the man is just supposed to be everything that's this rock, this hard piece. But I'm coming to realize that, oh shit, I have emotions that I have to deal with. I've been, you know, I remember as a kid, I used to get sandwiches and push them together, you know, and make them flat. And then if you get another sandwich and push it on top, it flattens out, but it's still thicker. Then if you keep going, that sandwich that was this big is going to be this big, which means you can't push it down anymore. And I've pushed a lot of things down in my life. I've haven't addressed issues. I had become someone that you could walk on. Like I became a yes man. And when I started going to therapy and speaking about these things, I realized that I don't have to be that person anymore, that I can be more than that. I'm a human, not just a doer. I'm not a human doer. I'm a human being. I've heard that in a song, and I have emotions, and I'm learning that I can have emotions, and I'm learning how to deal with them. And being in therapy, I fought so long not to go to therapy. I was like, no, I'm not crazy. I'm not going to therapy. I'm not doing it. And eventually I just broke and was like, forget it. I'll do it. And now it's a huge part of my life and my growth and my mental development and finding out my self-worth. And I'm also taking a lot of my therapeutic practices or my therapy practices and taking them and using them in my life, because we go to therapy and do therapy and talk about all this, the tools that we learn in therapy, we must utilize outside of that room. And that is the big thing that I've had to put in my life, is that consistency. I need that for myself. We all need it for ourselves. So yeah, therapy has done wonders.
And you know, and you can hold some of the tragedy in life, your divorce, I'm sure is a complex part of your life, but you can hold them both. You can hold all the good things that are happening too. Just share with us some of these good things that are happening with your voiceover work. And
oh my God.
Oh my God.
Well,
yes,
I'm going to be featured in the 7 Days magazine. There's a movie coming out where my voice is the main character, where I'm narrating this individual's life and how he came to be. And it's just, I have other things that are about to transpire that I really can't speak on yet. But it's crazy how I've had to learn, once you let go of something that's not for you, is when all the blessings come in. If you're holding on to something, there's no way that you can grab hold of this because you're holding on to something. And once you come to realize what's not for you, you let that go. And when you let that go, you open your hands. And when you open your hands, you're more susceptible to receiving blessings and understanding that the universe or life isn't against you. Since everything has transpired, I had to go through, I allowed myself 48 hours to deal with my emotions. And then I had to get myself back on this positive path because I'm not a depressed person at all. But people deal with bouts of depression, and going through things like this can bring on things like that. But if that happens, then everything that I've worked so hard falls by the wayside. Everything that I've been grinding to get will stop. And I've been grinding my ass off, and all these great things are starting to happen. So I'm truly blessed. I heard in this one song, he was like, you can't have the highs without the lows, you know, and my life is deemed to be just that, a lot of lows, but man, when it soars, it's taken off.
Yeah. And I just have to tell you, you, getting to know you, cause now we've talked maybe four times or a lot, getting to know you has reminded me of the patience that needs to accompany optimism. That to me is a big takeaway from meeting you and knowing your story, is that there is such a thing as being overly optimistic about an outcome. Yes. I mean, I think that, you know, you dove into so many things in your life that got you into hot water because you were so optimistic, because you had an idea and you are so passionate about ideas when they come to you. So, you know, I just can't thank you enough for sharing all that you have about your journey. I think we could spend a whole episode just on the cannabis podcast. So maybe we'll do that in the fall.
Absolutely.
But anyway, you know, I always ask my guests if there was, you know, just one thing that you want people to take away, or you know, what do you really wish people knew? Every day we're connected to other people's lives that we see have complexity and hardship, and maybe we've learned a little bit of something in our life that we'd love to share with them. What do you have for us? If there was just one thing you wish people knew, what would it be?
You get in what you put out. And whether that's positivity, negativity, bad energy, good energy, you get in what you put out. If you put in the work and do the steps, you can make it. Life isn't set up to be easy all the time. But when we find the joys in life and the positiveness in life and start to give out that positiveness, positive things will come. You get in what you put out.
Yeah. So, yeah. Absolutely. I totally agree. I can't thank you enough. Chris Brown, voiceover expert, cannabis podcast host, wise elder.
I like the wise.
Yes. Yes. I mean, you know, you're not that 26-year-old anymore that did race right into a lot of things that could look promising and some that weren't, but, you know, you're making the most of your life lessons in my book, and just sharing them with us like you have is a gift. So thank you so much, Chris Brown.
Absolutely. And thank you so much for what you're doing. And I know I've said it before, but the thought of conspiracy has always been a bad thing, like something that's hidden and something that's bad and there's secrets. But for you to put conspiracy and goodness together, and the goodness exchange is just it's you're putting a positive spin on words that have negativity. So,
well, I tell you, it's always been there. I just look around at the news and all the craziness on social media, and I say that is not who we are.
Yes,
who we are all the millions of people who are doing things large and small for others right now today, and who have always throughout history quietly led a revolution out of slavery, out of women's suffrage, out of, you know, human sacrifice, out of the gladiator phase. There were always people who just turned their backs on the negativity and the noise and quietly went about the business of doing right by others and doing right by the world. And that's who is out there right now toiling away in the conspiracy of goodness. I'll wrap up today with one little thing that I'm not sure I've shared very often on this podcast. So early on, I looked at that word. You're right to question the word conspiracy. And I picked it in a time when it was not a good thing. So many people canceled me against calling the podcast The Conspiracy of Goodness. But here's something interesting. The word conspiracy comes from two Latin words, con and spirare. Spirare means to breathe, and con means together. So what if breathing together is what you and I have just done for an hour and a half or more? We've been together in this in a really interesting way, digitally, but I felt like if I had lunch with you tomorrow, we'd just pick up right where we left off right now.
Absolutely.
Right? So let's all just use Chris's story and the wonders of all the other folks that we're interviewing on the Conspiracy of Goodness podcast and writing about at the Goodness Exchange, our mothership. Let's use those folks and folks like Chris as the markers of what's possible for all of us together. We can turn our back on the negative noise and the chaos builders and look for the people carrying a lantern for hope and progress. And you're surely one of them, Chris Brown. So I hope all the wonder and possibility that we turned you on to in this interview will help you through your week, and you'll be one of those folks carrying a lantern for someone else one day. Thank you so much, Chris Brown.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you.